Little Horus by Dan Abnett. Read by Martin Ellis. Look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it. Lytus remarks. Let us speak of Little Horus, Little Horus Aximand. His aspect was the half-moon, and his disposition, according to the humours, was inclining towards melancholia. This explained, many thought, his prevailing mood of sorrow and inner trouble, though he frequently denied it. The melancholic humour is misunderstood, he said. You think too literally. It has, in fact, the quality of autumn. It is the spirit of contemplative change, the accelerator of death, the enabler of ends and beginnings. Autumn clears away the world so that a new one may rise. This is my purpose. I am not sad. Of course, once they reattached his face, all he ever really looked was angry. Dwell lay in their path, and illumination was required. The dwellers were not old way ignorant. The shadows of the long night had been previously banished from their shores, and they had been compliant since their recovery 32 years earlier. The dwellers had supplied 80 fine, loyal regiments to the Crusade armies. Istvan was fresh in the memory, however, and blood-stained rumours of the infamy were spreading. A ferocious series of repercussive combats had flared through the Momed, Instar, and Oqueth sectors. The instigator was a leader of the Iron Tenth, a flesh-spare war leader of the Sorgol clan named Shadrach Meduson, and it was he who marshalled the loyalists against the approaching fleet of the War Master's 63rd expedition. Meduson and his formations had come too late to stand with their iron-handed master at Istvan V. Rage and calculated vengeance smoked in his alloy heart. He had gathered 58 full battalions of the Imperial Army about him, war hosts from the Momed Void Hives, along with a flotilla of siege hulks from Nahan Instar, a half-broken cadre of salamanders, some Mechanicum Claves, and a White Scars raid force rerouted from a return voyage to the Chondax warfront. Dwell, with its fortified cities, orbital batteries, ship schools, and 8 million pinnacle-grade fighting men, would be the cornerstone of Meduson's line, and any fool could see the elders of Dwell would never side against the throne. It was a matter of priority that their ignorance be illuminated swiftly, before they fell in step with the determined son of Medusa. Aximand's face had earned him his name, though he was not the only member of the 16th Legion who resembled the Primarch. For a good many, including the first captain, elective genetics had guaranteed it. They were sons, true sons, amongst the sons. Aximand was the most alike of them all. It was not only the face, there was something in the manner of him. Of course, he was Horus, too, a common, chthonic name made popular because of the Primarch. They were all sons of Horus in the end. Little Horus, that's what he was called, in tones simultaneously affectionate and mocking. Little Horus Aximand. There was nothing little about him. Captain of the 5th, 1/4 of the Morneville. He who serves as a captain here would be as a Primarch in the company of others, said Abaddon. And he was talking of Aximand when he said it. The reattachment left a scar. It set the character of the face differently, altered the seating of the muscles. Somehow, the wrongness, the imperfection, made him more like Horus, not less. Steel forged on Medusa had such a fine edge. He had a dream he never shared with anyone. First Captain Abaddon had indeed proclaimed that dreams were a weakness to be eschewed by all the Adeptus Astartes. The dreamless lunar wolves were surely the purest of all. But times changed. The lunar wolves had become the sons of Horus. Kin had become unkind. The All-Father of Man had become the enemy. And since Istvan, Little Horus Aximand had begun to dream. Every dream was essentially the same. Axemand would dream about the events of the day. The dream would match, in all particulars, his experiences, except that someone else was present. Someone else had come to join him, an intruder who remained just out of sight or in distant shadows, in the next room or the corner of his eye. Axemand could not see the intruder's face, but he knew he was there. Axemand could feel him watching. He could hear him breathing. Little Horus was afraid of the dreams at first. He was afraid to have started dreaming, afraid what Abaddon might say if he found out, afraid of the faceless intruder watching him whenever he slept. But he was not afraid of change. Change was, he insisted, part of his ruling character. "The melancholic humour is Protean," he said. "It possesses the quality of autumn. It is transformative, the accelerator of death, the enabler of ends and beginnings. Autumn clears away the world ready for renewal. This is my purpose. I am not afraid." Then again, after they reattached his face, all he ever really looked was unlike himself. Another change forced on them by the circumstances of Istvan was the loss of the Mournival. Changing the name of the 16th, changing the colour of their armour, those transformations had been embraced willingly as positive reinforcements of their resolve. They had never changed their allegiance. They still followed Horus and the Imperium. The Mournival, though, the Mournival was a painful loss. That small clique of sons, of peers, of brothers, selected to counsel the War Master, had always been vital, organic. Little Horus still wore the mark of the half-moon on his helm above the right eyepiece. As the fleet translated into the Dwell system, he spoke to Abaddon on the subject. "It is an antiquated concept," said the first captain. "See how poorly it served us at Isfan." "People served us poorly," Axemand replied. "Not the Mournival. The Mournival was always intended to provide even-tempered advice. It was supposed to provoke discussion and dissent, so that we could properly debate each issue and be sure of arriving at balanced reasoning." Abaddon looked at him, uncertain. Axemand smiled back. "It is true to say," he added, "that the decisions we had to make at Davin and Istvan were so extreme the natural dissent was..."
"Was what?" asked Abaddon.
"Intense. Those who lost the argument could not be permitted to live. It is the way of things. When the matter is so great, those who speak against it become our enemies. They had to say no, for in their no, our yes was consecrated."
"They." Abaddon and Axemand never spoke the names any more. Previous members of the Mournival, perhaps. Barabaddon, Cyrical, Janiper, and dear Sejanus. All of them were spoken of, as one would speak of beloved ancestors. But the last two to come and go, their names were never uttered. They were memories too painful for even a transhuman to bear.
"The mechanism always worked," Axemand pressed, dropping his soft voice to a leaf-rustle whisper, making Abaddon bend closer to hear. Below them, the vast bridge bustled with activity. "The mechanism always worked, even when we had to kill our dissenters. The method was valid and valuable. The Mournival provides balance and guarantees the right decisions."
"So you would reinstate it?" asked Abaddon.
"Do we not need balance now more than ever?"
"You would reinstate it?" Abaddon repeated.
"It was never gone," said Axemand. "There are simply vacancies."
"Who would you approach?" asked Abaddon.
"Who would you?"
Abaddon sniffed. "Targost?" Axemand shrugged.
"A sound suggestion. Sergar Targost is Heartwood like us, but he is also Lodge Master. The Lodge needs him clear-minded, not compromised by Mournival duties."
Abaddon nodded, seeing the sense of this. "Falcus Kibra," said Abaddon. Axemand smiled again. "Widowmaker Kibra was a true son, but he was also captain of the Justerin, and thus Abaddon's number two. Too much weight in one corner of the Legion."
"Kibra's an excellent man," he began.
"Callus Echidon," said Abaddon, before Axemand could finish. "Echidon, captain of the Catulan Reaver squad, another of Abaddon's company. Axamand wondered if Abaddon properly understood the concept of balance.
"You make a suggestion, then," said Abaddon.
"Tybalt Ma?"
"The either. He's a good man, but he hasn't got the stomach for the job. Not even now he's shaken off Moy's shadow.
Kibra is a good..."
"Gerard?" said Axamand.
"He's got his hands full taking the reins of the 13th now Sedere's gone," Abaddon replied.
"He's more than able."
"He is, but he has new responsibilities," said Abaddon.
"Grail Noctua,"
said Axamand. The first captain paused.
"Of the 25th Warlocked?"
"Yes."
"He's just a squad commander."
Axamand shrugged. He took up a silver cup from the side table and sipped.
"There is no rule that members of the Mournival be seniors or captains. In fact, if it were just composed of senior men, where would its point be? The Mournival is about balance and perspective. Wouldn't a good squad leader's insight complement the judgment of a first captain?"
"Noctua is a fine soldier," Abaddon mused.
"A captain in the making."
"He's young."
"We were all young once, Ezekiel."
Abaddon took up a cup of his own, not to drink, just to have something to toy with while he considered.
"There is precedence, of course," said Axamand. "To remind you, Cyrical was a squad leader when Lytus proposed him. He was ascendant. He was young, but Lytus saw his qualities. You've said yourself, Cyrical would have been first captain if he'd lived."
"The same could be said for many," Abaddon replied. "We should consult Lupercal and..."
"Why would we?" asked Axamand. "The Mournival has always been an autonomous body. Lupercal likes it that way."
Abaddon frowned. "I suppose. So, Kibra and Noctua?"
"Yes."
"You will approach Noctua if I make the overture to Falcus."
"Agreed."
"Put him in the line with you at Dwell," said Abaddon. "Measure him one last time to be sure. You know the old saying, measure twice, cut once." The Mausolytic Precinct was regarded as one of the top three objectives, along with the primary port and the City of the Elders. The precinct was sited on a high plateau overlooking Tygen and the Sea of Enna. In its great stone structures lay the dead of Dwell, each previous generation interred in ritual cybernation so that their collective thoughts, memories and accumulated knowledge could be accessed and consulted like books in a library. The Mausolytic Precinct was Axamand's responsibility. First Company would lead the attack on the City of Elders. Lithonen, the acting Lord Commander of the Army, would take responsibility for the port, with Gerard and the 13th as their spearhead.
"I would be disappointed if we were forced to lose a resource like the Mausolytic Precinct," the War Master told Little Horus. "But I would be more disappointed if we lost this fight. Burn it! Only if the alternative is losing."
"Yes, my lord," said Axamand.
"I would be disappointed if we were forced to lose a resource like the Mausolytic Precinct," the War Master told Little Horus.
The only light in the chamber came from the fire crackling in the great stone bowl.
"But I would be more disappointed if we lost this fight. Burn it only if the alternative is... Axamand?"
"Yes, my lord," said Axamand.
"Your attention is elsewhere, I think."
"Lupercal, I'm sorry. For a moment there..."
"What?"
"I could hear breathing, my lord."
The War Master regarded him with what looked like amusement.
"We all do it," he said.
"No, I mean, do you not hear it?"
"I hear weakness," said the War Master. "Where is this frailty coming from, Axamand? You're jumpy."
"My lord, is there somebody else in your quarters with us?"
"No. No, there isn't. I know this for a fact."
Axamand rose to his feet.
"Then who is that?" he asked. "Lord, who is that standing just there, on the other side of the fire?"
"Oh, Little Horus," said the War Master. "You are beginning to speak with the tongue of madness."
And just as Axamand realized that he was, he woke. He assembled his squad commanders and reviewed the tactical data. Axamand was, perhaps, the most scrupulous of all the 16th Legion's captains. He was not one like Targost, for example, who only ever wanted to know the fundamentals of a target or was annoyed by extraneous detail. Axemund liked to know everything, every last facet. He studied climate charts. He learned the names and phases of Dwell's 18 moons. He studied the intelligencer plans of the Morselitic Precinct and had the Fleetmaster's strategic architects fashion a sensory simulation he could walk through. He learned the names of his foe, the Tigenate Compulsories, a high-caliber division of ceremonial city troops whose duty it was, by tradition, to protect the precinct. The Chain Veil, an elite corps named after the ritual screen surrounding the thrones of the Elders of Dwell, who were rumoured to be supplementing the Morselitic defence. No confirmation had yet come of Medusan or any of his agents reaching Dwell. If he had beaten the 63rd in the race, it was thought unlikely he would position himself at the precinct. This role would probably be handed off to one of his trusted war leaders, perhaps Bion Henrikos, or to one of the White Scars' captains, such as Hibu Khan or Kublon Besk. "Let us hope for the 5th," said Lev Goshen, captain of the 25th Company, who was to command the second wave behind Axemund. "Ill-favoured for static defence, they will make themselves crazy waiting for our overture, stuck in one place." "The Scars should not be underestimated," said Grail Noctua, sergeant of the Warlock Tactical Squad. Goshen glanced up from the strategium display, looked at Noctua, and caught Axemund's eye. "He's got a voice, then," he remarked. There had been some murmuring amongst the upper ranks of the Legion when Noctua's role as second to Axemund for the Morselitic assault had been announced. "I've been advised I had better use it well, Captain," said Noctua. There was a reserve to him, a restraint that reminded Axemund of someone. Noctua had that true sun face, but the balance of humours was unusual. There was less of the arrogant charismatic and more of the calculated intellectual. Abaddon described Noctua as a blade weapon rather than a firearm. Goshen grinned. "Let's have your wisdom, Noctua," he said. "I had the honour to serve alongside a detachment of the 5th Legion 7 years ago during the Tirade system compliance. They impressed me with their battlecraft. I was reminded of the wolves." "The Lunar Wolves?" asked Goshen. "The Wolves of Fenris, sir," Noctua replied. "That's two enemies you've mentioned," said Goshen. "You understand they are our enemies, don't you, Noctua?"
"I understand they are both utterly lethal," replied Noctua. "Should we not appreciate the qualities of our enemies above all else?"
Goshen hesitated. "This terrace here, this parade," he said, returning to the chart display. "We will need air cover to achieve it." The briefing continued. Axemund thought for a moment that someone else had something to say, someone who had come into the room late to stand at the back of the grouped officers.
But there was nobody there.
"I hear you're considering Kibra and Noctua," said the War Master.
"You hear everything as usual," Axemund replied.
"Not Targost, then?"
"He has other responsibilities," said Axemund, "and we did not wish to dilute them."
The War Master nodded. He moved another carved bone counter across the board between them. Of all his sons, Axemund most enjoyed the practice and discipline of strategy games. The anteroom was furnished with many fine sets, most of them gifts from war leaders or brother primarchs. There was regicide, chatrange, Kataranga, Go, Neftiful, Zadrez, Mancala, Zatrikian. It was rare to find a Primarch's homeworld where a skill-honing wargame had not evolved.
"Ezekiel favoured Targos, didn't he?" asked the War Master,
as Axemund studied the field and contemplated his reply.
"He did, sir."
"And when you persuaded him against the choice, did you tell him the real reason, or did you manufacture one that would be more palatable to him?"
Axemund hesitated. He remembered the conversation with Abaddon, wherein he had not chosen to say that Targos, the captain of the 7th Company, was not a son, a true son. He was Chthonic stock. Axemund had not chosen to reveal that part of his disinclination. "I didn't," Axemen started to say.
"Tell him?" asked the Primarch.
"I didn't recognize my true motive," Axemen replied with reluctance.
"Interesting when you see it, though, don't you think?"
the War Master asked, sitting back.
"You and Ezekiel, Widowmaker and Noctua, all of you. What is it you call it? True sons?"
"True sons," Axemen echoed.
"So do you suppose," the War Master chuckled, "it is because you prefer the reassurance of a familiar face? Or is there another face you wish to block out?"
Dry air, cool, a faint hint of salt. The Sea of Enna in the flat rift valley below, like a sheet of glass in a culvert. Along its shore, the teeming city of Tijan, collected like flotsam, like multicoloured shingle. On the far side of the immense valley, across the back of the sleeping sea, the block line of the opposite valley wall, squared off and velvet black in the dawn light. The sky was violet, shot with stars and occasional moons. To the north, the pre-glow of the rising sun. To the east, the false dawn of the port, on fire since midnight. That was the handiwork of Gerard and 13th Company. In the high morning of the Morselitic Plateau, the buildings of the precinct stood like stone hangars for vast airships. Rectangles unadorned, they were faced with yellow stone rendered gold by the early light. In places, they were linked by soaring colonnades and porticos, goldstone columns the size of ancient redwoods. The pavements were made of etched steel, polished like mirrors. The atmosphere held a dry, static charge, as if great electromagnetic machines operated nearby. The vaunted chain veil made no appearance in the direct line at the precinct. Chain veil soldiers caused a brief delay to Abaddon's advance into the City of Elders. The first captain made curt, grudging reports of their determined resistance. Goshen's advance took a bastion west of the city, where the defenders boasted they were Chainvale, but Goshen was sure they were merely regular army, claiming to be the elites, so as to seem more intimidating. He slew them all, anyway. The Tijanate compulsories, resplendent in silver and crimson war gear, formed the main defence. The troopers were armed with long power swords, with energized axes and pikes, with munition loaders, with sonic tubes, with plasmic system weapons and las rifles. Entering combat, they engaged individual, segmented force shields, light-absorbing fog that dimmed the glory of their ritual uniforms, and made them look as if they'd each been enveloped in a hand-cut piece of storm cloud. The shields were annoyingly effective, and deflected most gunfire over a certain range. When a Legione's Astartes bolt round did pierce them, either through a direct hit or by finding the joint between segments, the compulsory inside detonated, and his explosive demise was contained, pressurized inside the shield, like a firecracker destroying a piece of soft fruit inside a bottle. The noise of it was dull, muted, like the slap of a muffled bass drum. It was infuriating. Dug in around the looming structures of the precinct, the compulsories were actually retarding a Legione's Astartes assault. They were holding the line against the 16th. Yet they were men, just men. Axemen felt a sense of injustice. The force shield certainly not the best he'd ever seen, but made effective by their individual mounts and portability, were giving the compulsories enough of an edge to bother the sons of Horus. It was an aberration brought about by circumstance. Human soldiers, no matter how good they were, did not resist transhuman soldiers. Axemen wanted to crush them, pulverize them for their temerity, to call in an orbital barrage, range shelling, or even one of the squadrons of super-heavy armour pieces that were basking nearby like vast crocodilian predators in the rising sun, waiting for his word to send them slipping down to the kill. However, any one of those actions would also raise the precinct. The compulsories were protected by the very buildings they were defending. Axemen had latitude, but he sincerely intended to prove he didn't need it. Less than 20 minutes from drop landing, the assault in the Morselitic precinct had grown bitter and choked. The Sons of Horus and their army auxiliaries had lost momentum. Their offensive stalled, all their advantages cancelled out by the clear-sighted deployment of professional soldiers exploiting their combat assets. Ye Durso, second captain of Axeman's company, cursed all the spirits of vengeance and destiny over the Voxlink. But Axemund knew Durso was actually cursing him. Zachary Scipion of Metalon Reaver reported his assumption of squad command. His sergeant, old Gaspia Youngquist, was dead. There was heat in Scipion's voice. He was calling for an apothecary. Zeb Zanonius of Bale Tactical reported two fallen. Somewhere, someone was breathing. Taking hits, driven into cover, Axemund looked up at the sky above the plateau. It was still flooded with the blue ink of night, but the pale margins were increasing. He could see four of Dwell's moons in the sky, one large, the other three not much larger than stars. Because of their relative positions, they were each in a different phase, full, gibbous, half, new. The sight of it let his anger breathe out for a second. It was, what, a sign? A portent? His vox tapped. Visor display identified the link as Grail Noctua.
"Forget bolters," said Noctua. "Blades!"
"Indeed," Axemund replied. "Getting close, and the fools do not stand a chance," Noctua replied.
Axemund smiled.
"Blades!" he yelled.
He locked his bolter to his hip and unsheathed his sword. Double-edged, power active, chthonic blue steel, etched along the fuller. He'd called it Mourn It All. His combat shield was already on his left arm. He didn't wait to see his order observed. He powered out of cover, lasbolts clipping his shield face and dinking his leg plates. Two big bounding strides put him on the colonnade, moving fast, head down, blade up. He saw the first of the compulsories up ahead, fogged in their shields, dug in around the massive pillars, firing at him. He could see their faces, pale and astonished. Transhuman dread. Axemund had heard iterators talk of the condition. He'd heard descriptions of it from regular army officers, too. The sight of an Adeptus Astartes was one thing, taller and broader than a man could ever be, armoured like a demigod. The singularity of purpose was self-evident. An Adeptus Astartes was designed to fight and kill anything that didn't annihilate it first. If you saw an Adeptus Astartes, you knew you were in trouble. The appearance alone cowed you with fear. But to see one move, apparently that was the real thing. Nothing human-shaped should be so fast, so lithe, so powerful, especially not anything in excess of 2 meters tall and carrying more armor than 4 normal men could lift. The sight of an Adeptus Astartes was one thing, but the moving fact of one was quite another. The psychologist called it transhuman dread. It froze a man, stuck him to the ground, caused his mind to lock up, made him lose control of bladder and bowel. Something huge and warlike gave pause, something huge and warlike and moving with the speed of a striking snake. That was when you knew that gods moved amongst men, and that there existed a scale of strength and speed beyond anything mortal, and that you were about to die, and, if you were really lucky, there might be just enough time to piss yourself first. Axemund saw that dumbfounded look on the faces of the dwellers he was about to gut and section. He heard the men of Fifth Company following behind him. He felt the joy of being Horus's son. Noctua was right. They had been wasting time and effort with guns and bolters. The shields were good enough to make the percentages of a firefight poor. The shields were good enough to stop blades, too. Bayonets, that was. Pole arms. A sabre. Maybe even a powered blade. But not for a moment, a powered blade driven by transhuman arm. The shields shattered. They cracked and broke with the sounds of smashing glass. Sharp chips of shield segment flew into the air for a microsecond after each blow before evaporating. The shield first, and then the body inside. The energy shell, then the meat. Blood exploded from the yawning wounds under pressure, jetting into the morning air, hosing Axemund and the great columns of the colonnade with arterial spray. Each sword stroke made an explosion of viscera, a puff of red in the air, as if a bag of blood had been detonated and its contents particulated. Whatever edge the Tigernate compulsories had owned, they lost it the moment the most advanced warriors in the Imperium remembered they were adaptable enough to fight the old-fashioned way. Blade and trade, strength of arm, sword school, close combat. The fifth made the entrance to the precinct less than 5 minutes after Axemund's inspiring charge. Axemund went into the thick of it with three sons at his side. Xenonius of Bale, Ger Garadon, and Mir Amindaza, both of Tithonus' assault. They went in at the end of the grand colonnade, under a gateway called the Arch of Answers. Dweller compulsories were packed in beneath the shadow of the vast archway, ready to defend the sunward entrances of the East Mausolytic Hall. The air was full of shots, like neon rain, horizontal. Energy bolts and tracer rounds shone especially brightly in the shade of the vast archway. The suns struck the line with their heads down and their shields up, sucking up the lancing gunfire, barreling compulsories over in a crush like a surging mass of rioters. Dwellers fell, their shields still lit, rolling and bouncing inside the hard light shells. There was a crush, a sense of crowd momentum, of thousands of bodies rippling as one mass. There were bodies underfoot, hands clawed, weapons fired point blank. The suns bit deeper. Their shields were ploughs and rams. Their swords were scythes and pikes. Compulsories dropped, spilling from their shredding, fizzling shields in tattered states. Blood sobbing and squirting out of the compromised fields. Blades hooked other men, hurled them into the air, their bodies spinning, tumbling, flailing overhead, above the crowd, crashing back down on the necks and shoulders of their kin. Some men were dead, upright, their bodies kept from falling by the press of the mass. The mirrored pavements were running with blood. The huge pool, draining out from under the fighting mass, spread its racing edges out across the etched steel, wider, broader, crimson in the sunlight, scarlet in the shadows, flooding around the bases of the columns, making islands out of plinths and pillars. The screaming voices of the compulsories were either muffled by their cocooning shields or rendered tinny and raw by the Vox intercept feeding into the comm systems of the Legiones Astartes. Most of the sounds, Axemund registered, were the concussive impacts as he chopped and barged and hacked. Mornitol was running red on its hilt and grip, blood smoke cooking off the powered blade. Blood had painted Axemund's sword arm to the elbow and was dripping off the edges of his vambrace. His shield boss was bruised and splattered with gore and brain matter. Behind everything, he could hear breathing. Xenonius moved past him, shield up, ripping through waists and hips and rib cages with broad horizontal slashes, bisecting bodies, rupturing shields. It was a devastating mechanical action, almost agricultural rather than martial. He was reaping his way through the enemy to reach the Mausolytic halls. Like a worker in a field of crops, he was cutting his row back and forth, swinging his long blade from the shoulders. To Axemund's left, Amindaza was treating it more as sport. His blade was shorter, and he toyed with the compulsories he was rushing, as if trying to engage them in combat and test their skill. He looked for blades to lock with, to deflect. No one met his challenge. They were too busy trying to fall back, out of the path of his butcher assault. Amindaza favoured hacking downstrokes, deep, crushing blows coming from over the shoulder that demolished his foes and smashed them onto the ground at his feet. Axemund could hear him calling out his enemies, daring them to fight him. He railed contempt at their attempts to retreat. He killed men, whether they were facing him or not. For his part, Axemund, like Garadon, preferred a more textbook mass assault form. Shield at eye level, used as ram, sword tip forward at chest level, punching and stabbing like a piston from under the shield rim. It was relentless.
It was like rolling a heavy piece of fruit into rows of toy soldiers and watching them knock down and scattered. The assault was so fierce that a brown smoke of aerosolized blood was fuming off the fighting line into the sunlight. Zenonius reached the East Hall entrance and slaughtered a dozen compulsories around the ornamental fountain and pool in the deep sunlit ante-hall. Larger cohorts of Axeman's company were on their heels on the colonnade. The lake of blood was so deep and swollen there was some pressure in it as it grew and spread. Bodies on the smooth, polished floor rotated in its current, end to end, like sticks of driftwood caught by an overspilling river. Axeman followed Zenonius into the ante-hall. The walls were sheer, the height of the hall impressive, though the floor plan was a small, square area with a central fountain. The top was open to the sky, so that sunlight could lance down and illuminate the quiet space, the polished floor, the clear water, the calyx and tulip carvings of the fountain's main figure. Blood spattered the floor and pooled around crumpled figures and broken weapons. Bloody handprints marked the edges of the fountain bowl, where men had struggled to prop themselves up as their last breaths escaped. On the intricately carved walls, jets of blood had left long pressure-pattern arcs, huge horsetail fans or fern-frond spatters. Some stretched 5 or 6 metres up the sheer walls. Axemond prowled forward. The place was almost tranquil. The din of fighting outside, muffled by the walls, sounded more like the grumble of a distant storm. Zenonius moved ahead, pausing to finish a wounded compulsory. Amindaza stepped into the light on the far side of the ante-hall, blade sizzling with frying blood. He had entered via one of the other doorways. Two compulsories and a precinct docent rushed him, and he turned to greet them with his sword. Axemond could hear breathing again. It was close now, closer than ever before, closer than a pulse beat in a man's brow. The breathing, the sense of presence had followed him out of his dreams and into his daily life. It had got closer and closer, until it was hovering at his shoulder. Now it sounded as though it was sharing his helmet, as though there were two heads in the one helm. Axemon stopped breathing for a moment to see if it was just some acoustic trick, an echo of his respiration. Silence. He was about to breathe again when it started, quiet but close, slow and calm, like the hushing of a gentle sea. "Where are you?" he asked.
"Say again!" Amindaza crackled over the vox. "Specify, sir!